My name is Justin Wilson, and I'm not a lawyer. I am. I play one on television. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I am IJ's vice president for communications. And so I was recently reading in the Wall Street Journal that with the advent of ChatGPT, an increasing number of professors are returning to the Socratic method to keep their students on their toes. And so I'm going to do the same thing. And we're going to go off script. And I'm going to be calling on some of the IJers in the back of the room and asking them a few questions as we go. Also, if any of your cell phones go off, I'll assume you're also volunteering. Okay, let's get started. Rob Frommer. Rob, stand up. This is how this works, right, Rob? Rob has no idea what I'm about to ask him. Rob, who do you think is the most influential judge in this country as measured by Google searches? Oh, yeah. Okay, Rob, the shtick was not supposed to work. You're not supposed to guess the right answer. Right? I recognize this is not a scientific study. I didn't know that Jerry Springer had a judge show, by the way. I looked that up and I went, oh my gosh, that guy did everything. Now, I recognize this is not a scientific study, but I think there's something interesting to be learned from it. Americans have an innate interest in the law, and the law, as a result, has become a central fixture in our popular and political culture. Just look at Judge Judy or Law and Order, which I think has been on television forever, since they invented the television. My new favorite is actually called Jury Duty. If you haven't seen it, come find me later and I'll tell you about it. We've got the rise of true crime podcast and true crime books. We're fixated on the law. But that fixation is a two-way relationship. The law is interested in us just as well. It's interested in our opinions and our beliefs and our values, in the facts of cases, and fundamentally the way that Americans perceive the courts. Judges and courts are part of the community, and they care about what the community thinks. And this gets at why IJ doesn't just litigate in the court of law, but also in the court of public opinion. Our North Star, the goal of every IJ case, is to win, to vindicate our clients' rights. Ideally, we win in a court of law and set a lasting precedent that prevents future abuses. And this is the first reason that we litigate in the court of public opinion. It helps us win in the court of law. So for instance, a few years ago, we were litigating a case in a town called Charlestown, Indiana. There was 350 homes, and the mayor was trying to get rid of them using his property maintenance code. He'd fined everyone tens of thousands of dollars. If we didn't win their case, many of them were going to be made homeless. IJ got involved. We filed for a preliminary injunction. The judge scheduled the hearing. Before the hearing, I arranged to have the local NPR station do a story on our clients. And when we got into court that day, the judge gets up and he says, well, this is going to be an interesting day. I was just listening to a story about this case on my way into work. And in that way, we had made our opening argument before the other side was even in the courtroom, right? More importantly, the judge could hear from our clients, to hear their actual voices and understand what was really at stake for them in that case. Needless to say, they are still in their homes to this day. In other circumstances, we win in the court of law before we even get into the court of law. A few years ago, we represented a traveling musician who kept all of his money in a speaker in his car. He got pulled over for not wearing his seatbelt. They found the money. They said, this is suspicious. They seized it. They never charged him with a crime. And he got in touch with us. We said, we're going to take the case. And I pitched an exclusive to Vox.com with a V and not an F. We have to always be careful about which one we're pitching, right? Because they sound the same. And the article immediately went viral. It like tore across the internet. And we were actually scheduled to be in court that day. And when we got there, it wasn't just the judge and the prosecutor, but there was a bunch of Wyoming state legislators. The judge made it clear he had read this article. He understood what was at stake. And he said, here's what you're going to do. You're going to put his money in a FedEx envelope, and you're going to send it to him overnight. And let me tell you, the wheels of justice do not normally turn this quickly. My colleagues and I, we have an informal competition on how fast we can win cases, and this is the record-setting, less than a few hours. Sometimes we don't win in the court. The best example, as you heard yesterday, is our Kelo eminent domain case, right? The decision sent shockwaves across the country. Because of the communication strategy that we put in place, Americans left and right alike were incensed. We were able to take the ensuing wave of public outrage and shape it into calls for change. And to this day, 47 states have made what happened to Suzette Kelo either illegal or unconstitutional. The bottom line is that we want to do right by our clients. We want to win by any means necessary. And actually, when I say any means necessary, I mean any legal means necessary. I was giving this speech to my parents-in-law, and they said, well, you got to say legal, Justin. You guys don't, you know. And I was like, yes, any legal means necessary. We also use communications to educate Americans about how the government abuses its power and what it takes to keep them in check. Okay, so that's why we invest so much time communicating. I guess the next question is, how do we actually do it? And we're going to start with another question. Paul Avalar, you're standing up in the back. Paul, what do you think is the most influential book or books ever written? You can pass, by the way, but it goes in your grades. The Bible. You're right, the Bible. Or I think, honestly, I think any other religious text, right? These have motivated millions. What's the tie that binds them together? They're told as narrative stories, right? They have characters. They describe human struggles. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. We know how the Bible ends. And this is what makes them memorable. Do you know what's not found in the Bible? Do you know what hasn't created a new religion? White papers, right? I used ChatGPT to create this one. Deconstructing Faith, a Postmodern Exegesis on Theoretical Semiotics and Hyperreal Narratives. Do you know what's not found in the Bible? Graphs, right? We have, I mean, this one, I guess, kind of makes sense. Evil is on the decline and salvation is increasing, but this doesn't motivate people. There's actually real scientific research to prove that narrative stories actually have a biochemical response. When a well-told story, we can remember it better. Now, the beauty of a lawsuit is it's just a story, right? It's a story of good and bad. It's a justice. It's a story of, if IJ is involved, justice prevailing over evil. But getting from a complicated legal argument that all the lawyers talk about to something that ordinary citizens find compelling is more complicated than it might seem. Now, you probably know lawyers love their Latin and their legalese. My husband's an attorney, and every once in a while, he'll say things like, ex ante, instead of the word before. And I look at him and go, are you kidding me? This is not a courtroom. But, you know, lawyers love their legalese and their Latin because they love and need precision. I think they also enjoy having a little secret code language around the office so the rest of us can understand what they're saying. So consider this press release that was written by one of our brand new attorneys. Sixth Circuit reverses Tennessee District Court's jurisdictional ruling, affirms its failure to state a claim ruling in part, and remands fines and fees case. It is not the most gripping press release. The way that we approach communications is to personalize, humanize, and dramatize. Around the office, we just say PhD, like we actually have advanced degrees. In short, that means focusing on our clients and their story, and not the courts and the law. It means using language that ordinary folks would understand. It means naming names. It means putting a face on the government. It means using that narrative structure, the beginning, a middle, and an end. And it means making the reader or listener feel empathy for our clients. Right? Same case. Same case, right? I think that's better. I think the idea of naming names is a really interesting one. How many of you have heard of Saul Alinsky? Okay, right, he's an activist, he's a teachers union leader, he wrote a book called Rules for Radicals. One of his rules is an interesting one. Pick a target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. That's the problem with the government. is that it seems monolithic. The phrase, you can't beat City Hall, is just that, that the government, when we call it that, seems invincible. But do you know who's not invincible? That evil mayor in Charlestown, Indiana, or an overly zealous agency head, or a politically connected commission chair. And that's who we're suing, and so that's who we're naming. Now, I can't take credit for this approach. How many of you know of Dale Carnegie? Right, right? Arguably, he wrote the other most influential book ever written, How to Win Friends and Influence People. He wrote it in 1936, and it's still required reading for a lot of students today. But before he wrote that, he wrote a lesser-known book called The Art of Public Speaking in 1915, so there he argues that we should personalize, humanize, and dramatize, you've heard that, specify, and visualize. In many ways, the way that we approach our communication strategy is to abide by the rule of good writing. You show, don't tell. Show people the abuses, don't tell them what to think. So let's talk about showing. Let's talk about Carnegie's V, visualize. Okay, next time we have another question. Bert Gall, you're back there. Is Bert here? No, I thought I saw Bert. Let's see. Oh, it's really hard to see back there. Diana, are you back there? Okay, where are our IJers? All right, I'm going to ask anyone. Dan Nepper. Come on, Dan. Dan, how many words is a picture worth? Is a very good guess, right? A picture is worth 1,000 words. You forgot that phrase was coined in 1915. A picture is worth 28,800 words and counting. And if I had known this, I would have been investing in pictures a long time ago. These days, it's not enough to just describe an abuse and hope it'll go viral on the internet. A recent study found that articles with photos receive 94% more traffic than articles without images. That's why IJ has an incredible team of photographers and cinematographers, many of whom are back there right now. We crisscross the country taking photos of our clients. In fact, Ed, are you here? There's Ed. Ed has more airline miles than anyone at IJ because of how many photos he's taken. Ed has taken some of these incredible photos, and we take photos that capture our clients' pain and frustration, photos that capture our clients' story. And our photos are not just for us to use. As newspapers struggle to keep photojournalists on staff, we make our photos available, and they've appeared on some of the front pages of every major newspaper in this country. And if a photo is worth 28,800 words and counting, a video is worth at least 10 times more. Our YouTube channel has received over 83 million views. Our videos regularly go viral. In fact, I was talking to one of our clients yesterday, and he said, well, my video only has 800,000 views and a lot of the other ones. And I said, 800,000 views is 8 Michigan Stadium-filled people. Go Blue. Do you know how many people are watching your video? Anyway, we have an incredible team, and I want to take a quick look at some of their work. I can't watch that video because it will make me cry. I've watched it many, many times, and honestly, I get choked up every time, and it speaks to the power that images have when they are combined with the stories and these abuses. Just take a look at this photo. It's Leslie Torres. She lives in Jonesboro, Georgia. Leslie's family's home was under threat from eminent domain. The city wanted to build a civic complex. But when she looked at the plans, she realized that the plans included a whole bunch of single-family homes. The city was going to replace her family's home with a better, nicer, richer family's home. So she got in touch with us, and we looked at her case and decided to take it. And before we could do that, we had to get photos. And so our photographer, Mark. Mark, are you back there? Mark, give a wave. This is Mark's photo. We pulled up to her home. Yeah, there you go. There's Mark. We pulled up to her home, and Mark and I go, you have to be kidding me. This is a white picket fence out of Mayberry. It was like the Andy Griffith Show, right? But there was a problem. That fence is in front of a 4-lane highway. And so Mark and I sit and stare at it, and we go, how are we going to get this photo? And so Mark says, okay, I can do this. And he crouches down in the middle of the highway, and I stand and look out for traffic. And Mark is doing this. He's like, get closer, trying to get the focus. 15 minutes later, we finally captured this photo. And it captured the story of the family. In the end, we didn't even have to file the lawsuit. So let's next go to Carnegie's next suggestion, which is that we specify. He wants us to give details and facts. There's a problem with stories is that they're just anecdotes. The economist Tyler Cowen actually gave a recent speech on the dangers of storytelling where he argues that the trouble with telling stories in the political and policy context is that they suggest patterns and trends where none exist. Now, Cowen's an economist, and so maybe he prefers the Bible in chart form for all we know, but I don't know, but I think he's got an interesting point. This is where IJ's strategic research department comes in. We have an incredible team of social science researchers, as you're going to hear from later, who are doing groundbreaking research to demonstrate that the stories of IJ's lawsuits are more than just happenstance, that the abuses we are combating are happening in cities and towns and commissions and agencies, that they're happening across the country. And they give us the facts to let us be specific. Okay, so take us from this complex legal theory to a compelling communications message, it comes down to three simple things. Simple facts, outrageous acts, and compelling people, and I think Bob McNamara is wrong. It's just three. It's a simple recipe. Okay, so once we figure this out, how do we put it all into action? The first thing we have to do is figure out what the media market looks like. Sometimes the worst abuses happen in the places of this country that no longer have newspapers. But people have an interest in knowing what's going on. Sometimes it's a simple Facebook page where people actually get their news. In fact, we launched a case in a Northern California county called Humboldt County, and we started looking at the media landscape, and we realized that the definitive news source, the place where everyone looks to find out what's going on in their community, is not some, you know, newspaper, the Register, or whatever it might be. It's a website called the Redheaded Black Belt, which is, as you might have guessed, a redhead who has a black belt who started blogging 10 years ago and has now become the only news source for a size of this, a part of the country that is almost the size of Connecticut. The second thing we have to think through is how we want to announce a case. In some circumstances, in order to avoid looking like carpetbaggers, we need to launch with a local press release and a local press conference with a local reporter. In other circumstances, we think, okay, this deserves a national story to bring a national spotlight on this outrage. The next step is to get our client to be in the public eye. Very few people lead a life that is 100% ready to be put under a microscope. As you've heard from so many of our clients, they didn't pick this fight, right? The fight picked them, and all of a sudden we have to get them ready to be put in the spotlight. So there's this thing in the law called the record, right? You've probably heard about the record. This is when we say, now I want to tell you for the record, as if we have court reporters that are always following us around, taking notes on what we say, right? That's the record. And whatever's in the record is what the judge can consider. But do you know who doesn't care about the legal record? Reporters. Reporters can ask any question under the sun of our clients. Do you know who really doesn't care about the legal record? Internet trolls. The kind of people who get joy at bringing anyone down for fun. And so we spend a tremendous amount of time working with our clients to get them ready for the incredible inundation of questions, comments, and the occasional snide remark that they're going to receive. The next thing is we have to write SOCOs, strategic overriding communications objectives. They're basically talking points kind of on steroids. The idea with them is to basically make the PhDs of the case clear and compelling. We write these, and from them flows our legal complaint, our press release, our media backgrounder, our YouTube video script, the email that we're going to send out when we launch the case, all of our social media posts. We use it to make sure that the case is always on message. Okay, I have question time. Actually, again, this is for the entire audience. There is one SOCO in an American lawsuit that I bet all of you remember, and I'm going to give you one hint. If the glove don't fit, right? If you're at least my age, you probably remember that. Why do you remember it? It rhymes, it's short, it was repeated, which is what we're trying to accomplish. So at this point, we've spent 3 or 4 weeks getting ready for the lawsuit. And on the day that we are going to launch the lawsuit, it starts with our incredible team of paralegals. They wake up so early in the morning and get filed as soon as the courts open so that we have the best opportunity to get media. If we're going to have a press conference, then we're usually standing on a street corner in the middle of somewhere in America. Usually the courthouse that we've just filed is behind us. And we're waiting for the TV cameras to show up. I've been doing this for, 10 years now. And it is still, to this day, one of the most nerve-wracking parts of my job, because there's never a guarantee anyone's going to come. In fact, we once had a press conference where they all showed up, they put all their TV cameras together, and before we started the press conference, they started disassembling them. And I went over, what's going on? We haven't actually done the thing. And they said, oh, there's an apartment fire. And we're going to go get footage of this apartment fire. And I said, if it bleeds, it leads. But we're prepared for that, right? Nowadays, we bring our own camera, and we live stream our press conference on the internet. At the same time, we're launching our YouTube video, we're posting our press release on Facebook, and we're tweeting out threads about the case. And I don't know if we call it tweeting anymore, but Xing sounds like a weird thing, right? Xing, I was Xing this. It's a waiting game. Within like a fraction of a few minutes, we're gonna know if our video is gonna go viral. YouTube analytics, we see the hockey stick. And by about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the first articles start to appear online. And the question on everyone's mind is, how is the government going to respond? Usually they just say no comment. If they do that, then we've done a good job. But in other circumstances, they just say, you know what, we're going to reconcile. We actually once caught a city in Florida so flat-footed that they had to hire what they call these crisis communications firms, the spin artists, to turn around the story, right? They're like, oh, we can turn around this story, or we're not that bad. They were a terrible place. They were fining a guy almost $29,000 because his grass got a little too long. And when we got a hold of the contract for the crisis communications firm, we realized they were paying the crisis communications firm more than they had fined our client in the first place. And so what did we do? Oh, we just turned it over to the press, and they had another really bad day. Okay, I am going to take a page from my own advice. I am going to tell you a story, right? Narrative storytelling, PhD, all of that. How do stories begin? Once upon a time, on a land far, far away, actually it was in Reno, so not that far, my attorney calls me up and he's like, hey, Justin. I'm like, hey, Wesley, what's up? And he's like, I've got this case. Do you have a second? Yeah. It involves a former Marine who is driving from Texas to Nevada to visit his daughters. He had his life savings in his backpack. It was about $80,000. He was pulled over. The police seized it, and they're trying to keep it forever. They left him on the side of the road with $7. And I said, that sounds terrible, but like my first question is, well, what the heck was he doing with all that money in a backpack in his pack? And so I have another Socratic question. Let's see. Stephen Lara, are you here? Okay, Stephen, stand up. Stephen, why on earth did you have that much money in your own backpack? Okay, I mean, Stephen is a plant. So, Stephen, why don't you come up here? We're going to talk about this whole situation. Sorry. All right, Stephen, we're going to ask you the hardest question first. Why did you have that much money in your backpack? Because that was the question that the reporters wanted to know.
Well, you know, I was banking with Wells Fargo, if any of you all know what happened with that. There was some excessive fines and fees, and, you know, there was some lack of professionalism and timeliness issues. And I said, you know what? Enough is enough. I'm just going to take my money out and... you know, I'm going to just go ahead and just, you know, I felt more comfortable doing it that way instead of keeping my money in the bank. And, yeah, that's basically why.
So take me back to the beginning of this case. Like, you got on the road and you were driving to Nevada.
Yeah, so, you know, I was, as you had stated, you know, I was visiting my daughters up in a place called Portola, California. It's up in the north, not too far from Reno, about an hour away. And I'm driving from Texas. Driving up the road, probably about a good maybe 15 minutes out from Reno, you know, about a 24-hour trip, so, you know, it's pretty daunting. So, you know, I had went up there to to visit my daughters, and next thing you know, I'm getting pulled over, you know, by Nevada Highway Patrol. It was pretty confusing, actually, because I had my car on cruise control, and I'm driving through right-hand lane. I'd got some good rest the night before, and just absolutely confusing as to why I was even being pulled over in the first place.
So when the police officer, you know, you were in the Marines, you kind of know how this works, and we've got this incredible video of yours. You know, you kept your calm head when he walked up to the window and told you what was going on. Walk me through that.
Sure. So, you know, as I had said before, it was just a matter of, I was really confused, like I said. I thought, you know, I was in a rental car, so I was trying to figure out, you know, maybe I had expired registration or something like that, you know. He was very, very nice talking to me. As a matter of fact, I went back and looked the body cam this morning. I wrote this down for you, okay, because I want to read this verbatim. You can't make this stuff up. So he says to me, "We have a special enforcement campaign going on, and we're trying to educate drivers about violations they may not know they're committing. I would like to applaud you on your driving. You drive great, slow, and appears you are driving safe and under the speed limit." Like, what? like, really? Okay, so you want to see my license, registration, and insurance, you know, so... yeah. So he then asked me, can you step out the car? Okay, sure. I'll step out the car. And then he went on to ask me about a lot of questions that weren't even, I mean, had nothing to do with a traffic stop whatsoever. He had told me that he had pulled me over for driving close to a tanker truck. And I don't remember that. But nevertheless, I was very compliant. I was very professional. I had nothing to hide. So I just, you know, was answering all his questions. And, initially, after he asked me to pull over, he had asked me if I was carrying any firearms, if I had any bodies in the car, any explosives, if I had cocaine, or any excessive amounts of cash. And I was like, what? What does this have to do with being pulled over with driving too close to a truck? So, you know, I was confused, but like I said, I was very compliant just because, you know, I just wanted to ensure that my professionalism regarding the situation came through so I could be on my way to see my kids. I mean, for God's sakes, that was my purpose, and I was, you know, that close.
I watched the video, the full video. This is the coolest cucumber under fire I have ever seen in my life. Here's a cop accusing him of everything, and he's like, "Nope, I'm gonna keep explaining it to you, calm and collected."
I've seen some things in my past, unfortunately. Cop didn't scare me, and he said I was looking nervous. I'm like, "What is that? What is it? I'm confused. You know, what are you talking about, nervous?" But okay. And then so, he contacted the DEA agent to come out to the site, at that time. He had asked me if I had any excessive amounts of cash. And I told him, I said, "Look, I got money in my backpack." I told him exactly where it was. I said, there's receipts in there to accommodate those monies. I said, "So you can look through my receipts. You're free to look through it. I have nothing to hide. I just want to be on my way. No problems." And I put full faith and confidence in his profession, you know, and him being a professional, being a law enforcement officer, right? And so he contacted, later I learned he tried to contact a DA agent to go out there. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it out. And so he contacted a sergeant to go out there on site, which he showed up about 20 minutes later. And when he showed up to the site, he had continued to try to grill me regarding these monies and things as such. And on his body cam footage, which I had learned at a later time, he told, once again, I'm not going to make this up, okay? He told the DEA agent on the phone, "It's real easy to do an adoption. I'll send you the money count in a couple of hours."
Explain what an adoption is.
Adoption meaning basically stealing my money in this case. I mean, that's the easiest way to put it, okay? Because they were looking for drugs, which weren't there. I've never done drugs in my life. I mean, if you asked me, I wouldn't even know where to get drugs, like honestly. And so, you know, they get the dog out there. We're waiting longer to get the dog. Now, this happened first. He got on the phone with the DEA agent, and then they get the dog out there to search the vehicle. I wasn't worried about that. Send the dog. So, you know, the dog searches the vehicle. Of course, I don't find anything. So the officer takes my cash. And if you look at that black pillar or that black piece back there, he took it about that far, okay? Put my cash in the bushes there. And then the same man who did that brought the dog, and the dog led him to my cash. And then went over to the sergeant, and the sergeant said, hey, let's go through with it. Okay. And so next thing you know, I'm being told, hey, we think these are illegal drug proceeds, and we're going to go ahead and confiscate your cash today. And I said, listen, sir, I said, I was very, you know, very professional. I said, listen, sir, I understand you're just doing your job, but I said, I only have $7. How am I supposed to get my rental car back? I got to see my children. How am I supposed to pay for my hotel? How am I supposed to provide for my kids and get back? I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry too. But you know what? This isn't over. And so, you know, I had to get with my brother to wire me some money so that I could, you know, spend time with my family and make it back to Texas.
So one of the most frustrating things about civil forfeiture is that it takes innocent until proven guilty and flips it on its head. And to take on Stephen's case, we have to fight and prove his innocence, which meant that we had to go through your taxes, go through a stack of receipts that you'd kept, which was great, right? And we even had to call your ex-wife. Tell me what it felt like having to have your life kind of turned upside down to try to prove your innocence.
It was demoralizing. I mean, I'm a very private person. You know, I mind my own business. I take care of folks, you know, any chance I get. That's just who I am. I mean, I'm pretty sure you all feel the same way. I mean, how would you feel if somebody walked up to you and says, hey, let me see your taxes. I want to see your bank receipts. I want to go, let's go back X amount of years and figure out, you know, what it is. I want to know where you spent your money. I mean, it was demoralizing for me to try to justify why, you know, why this happened. But at the same time, I felt very comfortable doing so because, you know, as I was standing there in front of the officer who was taking my money, and you know, I have a smile about it now, but I was actually smiling inside because I was thinking to myself, this guy has no idea who he's messing with, man. Let me tell you something.
So
I keep tight. Sorry. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I keep tight documentation, and you know what? They couldn't pull over the worst person.
So for us to take one of these cases to the media, we knew that the media is going to ask the same questions that we ask. So we do a lot of work to vet our clients and make sure that their story checks out. Stephen's story checked out completely to the point that we called his ex-wife. And then I said, you know what, it's go big or go home. I called the Washington Post's chief justice reporter. I said, Matt, hey, we've got a good relationship. I said, Matt, you know, I think you should do this story. It's a federal story. It's happening across the country. Thank you to our strategic research team. We have proof that this is a common occurrence. He said, yeah, I'll do the story. Now, what was it like when the next thing you know, you're on the phone with the Washington Post?
Well, you know, it was a breath of fresh air because that was my opportunity to get my story out there and to inform those that, you know, out there in the public that had no idea that this even existed, because I sure didn't before that unfortunately happened. But it was a breath of fresh air being able to share my story and just be able to make a footprint and get my words heard, because I finally felt like I had a voice, right? I mean, there's people out there that don't have the opportunity to speak to you folks. They don't have the opportunity to be here and have the IJ take on their case. I felt very fortunate. And I kind of feel guilty, actually. I was telling some folks yesterday at dinner, I feel guilty because There's a lot of people out there who may be homeless. There's a lot of people out there who may have taken their life. And you never hear about their story. And here we are. And, you know, there's a little bit of guilt in me. But I was very thankful to be able to have that voice and be able to be heard.
So we start working with the Washington Post. Everything was kind of happening last minute because of timing of filings. I flew out to Reno. We ended up having to take photos about 4 hours before the story was going to run. So Stephen and I are on like the side of the road. I am taking pictures of him. I'm editing them on my computer, shooting them off to the Washington Post. They're putting them on their website. And the story goes online at around 6 in the morning the next morning. And then, so that's 6 in the morning Eastern time. We're all asleep in a hotel in Reno. So my colleague Wesley, the attorney on the case, gets a phone call. And it's this reporter. And he goes, hey, the story went online. The DEA originally said no comment. They read the article, and they've called me back, and they're going to give back all of his money today. So Wesley and I are sitting at the breakfast bar, and we are waiting for Stephen to come down. And we're like literally like so giddy. We're like gonna get that guy who doesn't have any idea. We can break him the good news. And I remember the elevator doors open and you have a grin on your face. Do you remember what you said to me?
I already know. I said, I already know. I didn't tell Justin this, but I didn't go to sleep the night before. It's not that I was nervous. It was just, I couldn't stop thinking about the situation, and you know, I couldn't sleep, and I was ready for the next day. I was motivated. I was just ready to go get some, and you know what? I had just happened to do some Google searching just to see if anything had popped up, and I was like, yes, right.
So we had our press conference. We got a bunch of other additional media. The case is going to continue on. The way we file our forfeiture lawsuits, just giving back the money no longer makes these cases go away. And we actually did a YouTube video about your case, actually a month later. That YouTube video has received more than 10 million views. It is one of our most viewed videos. What's it like to be in that kind of a limelight?
I got to be honest with you. I'm not one to like being in the limelight. I like to give credit to others. I don't like to take credit or anything like that. And like I said before, I'm a really private person. But it made me feel really good to be able to get the story now out to the world and share my experiences so that we could educate people along the way to maybe be a little bit, you know, to think outside the box and to understand that there is injustice here within our country. And to be aware of things that they may not know exist. So to be able to reach out and touch folks on social media, which we obviously live in a time where that plays very heavy on a lot of things, where it was once the news or even the paper at your door, social media has a very big footprint. It was very great. It was great to me to be able to get that word out there, and at the same time, you know, DIJ to be able to inform those viewers of the injustice that we live in. And I just think that, you know, the IJ has done an outstanding job in doing that.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen. As I said, Stephen's case is continuing on. We actually argued our motion to dismiss on Thursday, and we hope to have some good news. So, all right, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.